Well, welcome, and thank you very much for coming to the section on insect-symbiont interactions. My name is Ken Raffa. I'm at University of Wisconsin in Madison, and my co-moderator is Keir Klepsik with the USDA Forest Service. I wanted to give you a little bit of background on this symposium and how it came about. About 2 years ago, a few of us met and discussed that there really was no appropriate outlet in the ESA journals for articles on symbiosis. There were sections on related issues such as insect vectoring of pathogens, insect pathogenesis, but not really for the appropriate area of symbiosis. And so we approached the editor-in-chief, Alan Cameron, on this, and Alan was incredibly receptive and said, yeah, we really encourage you to go in this direction. And he did us one better. He said, why not organize a symposium to help launch the new subsection? And that actually is the history of this. This was Alan's brainchild, and I think it was a great idea. And so it's going to be launched in February of 2009. We have a subject editor, and that's going to be Keir Klepsik. And we have four folks who have agreed to be associate editors, Kelly Hoover, John McCready, Dwayne Shoemaker, and myself. And I want to thank all of the individuals who agreed to do that. And hopefully amongst the five of us, we can provide good representation for the various sub-areas of symbiosis and good representation of different types of institutions. And at the end of the introductory remarks I make, I'm going to leave some time for anybody who has any suggestions or comments or whatever about the new subsection to go ahead and share some of those ideas with us. So what I'm going to do, just to kind of kick things off, is just give a general overview of what's encompassed with symbiosis, some general trends about where the areas are going. And then I want to talk about some of the broad biological themes that can very much benefit by the study of symbiosis. And I'm just going to highlight a couple of things. It's certainly not going to be comprehensive. I just want to sprinkle it with a few illustrations to try to convey the breadth of the area. Then just say a few opportunities about how studying microscale communities do have some conserve as useful models for some ecosystem scale issues. And then make just a few concluding remarks about what I see as some of the major challenges to studying symbiosis right now. So if we try to start with, you know, what do we mean by symbiosis? Obviously, this has been a rather contentious area over the years, but I just wanted to highlight some of the major definitions that have arisen. And it goes back to 1877 and 78, when they gave the examples, all of the cases where two different species live on or in one another and the living together of differentially named organisms. And I think that really is the framework. And the most recent definition is by Zook, the acquisition and maintenance of one or more organisms by another that result in novel structures and or metabolism. And that's the definition of symbiosis that we'll be using here. But we don't want to be rigid of it. In the thematic paper that Keir became first author on, he used the expression, the futility of strict classifications. And I really like that choice of words. And so I don't see any benefit to really getting bogged down in really strict definitions. I think if we stand back and look at what's happened over these years, there are a number of trends, but some of the significant ones have been a movement from a study that was primarily from the standpoint of individual organisms, and they kind of viewed symbionts as tools that those individual organisms had for contending with the environment. And instead now, most of the emphasis is on the interaction itself. Secondly, the early studies had very strict categorical definitions. And I think these served a very useful purpose because they helped organize our thoughts. But that having been done, I think much of the emphasis now is on transitioning functions in space and time, and also context-dependent relationships. And we'll hear some good examples of that in today's talk. And then likewise, the earlier talks on symbiosis, for the most part, dealt in dual partner relationships. Many of the best and most eloquently worked out models still are dual partner relationships, but we're seeing more and more examples now of very important multipartite relationships, and we're going to hear about two or three examples of that today. When we look at, you know, what are the big areas of biology that benefit from studying symbiosis, I think very much at the forefront is evolutionary theory. And this has been approached from at least five different approaches in symbiosis, and I've just listed here. One is phylogenetic approaches, how closely related groups of insects are associated with closely related groups of fungi and closely related groups of bacteria. Also from the standpoint of the evolution of structures that support the symbiosis. Looking at it from a very different standpoint, going back to the work of George Carroll, exploring plant-insect interactions from the standpoint of a plant endophyte symbiosis and how that very much mediates the plant-insect interaction. And he really addressed the point back then of how does a long-lived plant, such as a tree, stand the chance in the evolutionary chemical arms race between insects and the plant. And his conclusion to that was that endophytes play, and their very short turnaround time, are an important part of that. A huge area is Wolbachia infection and how that can result in reproductive isolation and potentially diversification. And recently revisiting the notion of superorganisms, and as they're now sometimes referred to as hologenomes, and looking again at what really is the unit of selection, and that not necessarily being the individual, but it being the entire collage of the individual or a macroorganism and all the microbes associated with it. I think another major area is plant-insect interactions. That likewise is benefiting from study of symbiosis from a couple of directions. Probably more work has been done on digestion than any other aspect of symbiosis, and lots of examples where direct digestion is facilitated by these interactions, and also indirect, and by that I mean agriculture, as in the examples of the ants and the ambrosia beetles. And in terms of plant defense, again, looking at it broadly, there are a number of examples where the ability of a plant to defend itself against insect herbivores is mediated by the plant's symbiotic relationships, in some case endophytes, mycorrhizae, and not only constitutive plant defenses, but there's also evidence now that some inducible plant defenses are likewise mediated by plant symbioses with endophytes. Tritrophic interactions, certainly another very large, broadly encompassing area in biology. Host location by natural enemies, work by Terlings and his colleagues have shown that parasite behavior is influenced by pathogenic infection of the plants. And even beyond that, in some cases, parasitic insects are using cues, using metabolic signals by symbionts of herbivores as cues for host findings. And there's examples of that both with wood wasps and with bark beetles. Some other examples of tritrophic interactions, we're going to be hearing from Oliver today, but in their work they've shown that herbivores gain protection from parasitic insects through their symbiotic relations with endosymbionts. And flipping the tables, if you will, the empire strikes back. Parasitoids are able to suppress the immune responses of herbivores by using symbiotic viruses, and some very nice work by Bekage and her colleagues and Webb et al. And also examples where herbivores obtain protection from antagonistic fungi, some work by Jasmine Cardoza and also Scott et al. And other examples of that. I think another big broad area to keep in mind is the whole issue of context dependency and net effects rather than these traditionally very strictly defined types of relationships. a great example, and one I think should be required reading for anybody interested in symbiosis, is the relationship between fungi and black flies, where McCrady and colleagues have shown that the relationship is commensal when the food resources of the larvae are high, but when the food resources of the larvae are low, it becomes a very strong mutualistic relationship. And if that's not complicated enough, there's even a parasitic relationship with the adults in terms of ovary reduction. I think another example of this is what happens when you have multiple symbionts. That produces trade-offs. Again, no longer this notion of these very strict categorical definitions. The combined infection results in even enhanced infection defense against parasitic insects, but it comes at a cost, and that cost comes in terms of fecundity. And so again, this is just intended to set the stage for some of these kinds of examples. For those who are interested in insect communication and social organization of insects, again, it frequently comes down to symbionts. Symbionts have been shown to play crucial roles in pheromone biosynthesis in locusts and in bark beetles, and play a very important role in nestmate recognition in ants. And scaling up a little bit, thinking about population dynamics, some very nice work by Richard Hofstetter and Matt Ayers and Keir Klepsik and their colleagues have shown that the reproductive output of southern pine beetle is very strongly influenced by the relative composition of antagonistic and mutualistic fungi, and that in turn is very strongly influenced by the activities of the symbiotic mites. And in a similar system, also having landscape scale effects, Diana Six and Barbara Bentz have shown that temperature influences the relative abundance of the two major fungal symbionts of the mountain pine beetle, and that in turn has differential effects on mountain pine beetle success. And obviously this has very strong implications to global climate change scenarios. In terms of pest management and biological invasions, some really nice work has shown that symbiotic bacteria can actually determine which species of stink bugs are active pests or not pest status on legumes. In terms of invasive species, I think many of us have come to the realization that we really shouldn't be talking about invasive species. We should be talking about invasive species complexes. Many of our most problematic invasive species show close associations with symbionts, and I think Matt Ayers is going to be talking about that to some extent. There are examples where native insects acquire symbiotic relationships with introduced phytopathogens, and also examples where invasive insects both acquire new symbionts in the new zone and also maintain some of the old symbionts with them. Again, not necessarily the strict categorical definitions. I also think there are some opportunities for using symbiotic relationships as models for broader scale issues that would not normally be tractable. For those of us who are interested in cross-scale interactions and we're interested in issues about community ecology and landscape ecology, a lot of times the critical tests are not experiments that you really would be able to do. And in fact, we now are developing the ability to manipulate communities within individual insects by introducing invasive species, by introducing genetically modified organisms, and testing some of the broad theories of community ecology, such as stability, such as resistance, actually doing controlled studies of invasion theory. Many of us have been concerned about what are the properties of invaders? What are the properties of invasible ecosystems? What are the roles of allele effects? Which intervention tactics are most likely to work? What are the large ecosystem scale consequences of introducing GMOs? These are experiments that would be both impractical to do in nature and also unethical to do in nature, and yet there may be opportunities to using individual gut communities or other forms of symbiotic associations to do controlled, manipulated experimental tests in the laboratory. The last thing I wanted to say about ecosystem scale opportunities is there are also some novel opportunities for improved integrated pest management. Novel targets, actually treating the symbiotic interaction itself as a target for manipulation and improving our ability to control insects. Improved sampling tools, and just some of the examples of that would be what I alluded to earlier, that parasitic insects often cue in on the metabolites of the symbionts of herbivores, and that may provide some opportunities for improving our sampling capabilities. Something that has already reached some level of practical realization, endophyte-based resistance, particularly in the turf area, and I think there's more and more opportunities for there. And in an entire new and emerging field, and there was a whole symposium developed to that, devoted to that this morning, enzymes for bioenergy, alternative energy sources. And in many cases, there are many examples now where symbionts of insects have been shown to have cellulolytic and or lignocellulolytic enzyme activity, which is so crucial for this kind of work. And I've just listed a few examples, and for the most part right now, our knowledge of this is centered on wood-boring insects, where you would, in fact, to see these kinds of capabilities and these types of symbionts. Well, all of that having been said, there are some major challenges to the study of symbiosis, and I've just listed a few of them here. One is for each of the various systems where we're trying to take a more holistic systems level approach, there are variable abilities in our capability to manipulate the system. Some of the systems lend themselves quite well to manipulation. Some do not. Sometimes the barrier to manipulating the system may have something to do with the behavior of the insect itself. In other cases, it may have something to do with the properties of the microorganism. And even things like using antibiotics, which a lot of us have done in our experiments, that's still somewhat of a rather blunt sword. And as we look ahead towards more refined phage approaches to manipulating the system, I think there's a lot of reason for optimism. A second challenge is what I put there is just the age-old problem of characterization versus function. And this is true of all areas of community ecology, and in some ways symbiosis is community ecology. You really can't understand what they're doing until you know who's there. You really can't understand who's there until you have some idea of what kind of process is going on. And there's always an interplay at this level. And then a third major area I've listed here is the whole area of quantitative analysis. Many of our improvements of methodology in symbiosis have come in the molecular area, but with that, we're needing more and more appropriately designed quantitative tools. For example, it's often difficult to obtain the adequate sample size of the appropriate experimental unit for statistical analysis. Many of us have done rarefaction curves, for example, of clones, and gotten some good measure of our degree of sampling. But really, that's not sampling, that's subsampling, because ultimately, your unit of replication is the individual insect. And there are not very many studies yet where we have adequate sampling, both at the subsample and sampling level. And then secondly, quantifying the sources of variation to properly design comparative studies. At what level of, at what various levels of space and time do we see different levels of variation, and to what extent can that guide us to improve the statistical power of our experiments? And we have a all-star lineup here. I'm not going to read those for you, but I think you're going to really enjoy the diversity of presentations here. One unfortunate note, we had a last-minute withdrawal due to a health issue last night. Laura emailed me and said she will not be able to make it And so we'll simply make the break twice as long. And is it time to introduce Cameron, or is there a time for a question?